Yes, and welcome to Animal Voices this long weekend, May the 16th, and we have a very special program for you today, and it's going to involve the complete hour, because I believe it's such a significant and true to our times program. Many of our, and we're going to be playing Ingrid Newkirk, who was the founder of and the CEO of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. Everybody knows them as PETA. She gave a wonderful presentation in Israel. It's called Nonviolence Includes Animals. And it's going to be 60 minutes. Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices on CFRO Radio, 102.7 FM. Many of our programs are posted on our webpage, animalvoices.org. John Pranger is our technician and co-host. Thank you, John, for being here for us today, as Alan Jensen is away this weekend, and Marge Adams is taking a breather.
But you should give out the new website, Carl.
Our website is animalvoices.org.
What about the other one?
It remains the same.
Oh.
It absolutely remains the same.
Oh, I see.
So, anyway, so over to you, John, and the foreword is by Dennis Kucinich, who ran for the White was running the White House for the White House, and he is a vegan, so he didn't have a very successful campaign, but he speaks out for the animals as much as Ingrid Newkirk does and her wonderful organization called People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
Most of us would agree that the three most precious words in any language are peace on earth. It is what we all say we want.
I can't hear it.
And it is what anyone caught up in war longs for. Yet on any given day, there are dozens of wars being fought in the world. Each one causes great physical pain and suffering, displacement, fear, death, and grief. Some wars are fought for land or other resources, some for religious or cultural domination, or out of fear of being attacked first. But all wars require that we cope with the destruction of life by abandoning our good nature. We do this by lumping every individual together, including children, the elderly, kind and peaceful citizens, into one indistinguishable mass, which we label our enemy. It sometimes takes courage to go against the grain and to say and do what our heart tells us is right. In December 2005, Ingrid Newkirk, the president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, traveled to Palestine to address the conference on nonviolent resistance. Her message was that the principles of nonviolence require us to re-examine our relationship with the animal nations. I hope her talk inspires in you a desire to help increase the sum total of peace on earth every single day of your life. Thank you.
It is my great pleasure to address so many kind people gathered at this conference to share strategies and seek solutions. Everyone listening is a person of principle, and today I must ask you to open your hearts and minds to the possibility that how we treat animals is an issue which goes to the very heart of who we are. It helps us determine if we have grasped the most basic problem facing those who wish to resolve conflicts, a lack of empathy for others who are not exactly like us. It is an interesting exercise that requires us to challenge our most ingrained prejudices, just as we challenge others to confront theirs. A Jewish gentleman told me a joke that you may well have heard before, but I had not. It seemed to fit perfectly with my own situation and perhaps with yours. It's about a CNN reporter who went to the Western Wall to do a story on a very old man who'd been going there every day, twice a day, to pray. She finds the man, and she watches him pray for 30 to 40 minutes. As he turns to leave, she approaches him, and she says, "Sir, how long have you been coming here to pray?" The man says, "Almost 40 years, twice a day, every day." "That's amazing," says the CNN reporter. "And what do you pray for?" The man says, "I pray for peace between Christians and Jews and Muslims. I pray for all hatred to stop. I pray for our children to grow up with understanding." "I see," says the CNN reporter. "And how do you feel, given all the strife and the attacks and the bombings?" "Well, I've got to admit," says the old man, "sometimes I feel like I'm talking to a wall." I think everyone here can relate to that. Faced with disinterest, disdain, and even outright hostility to the idea of embracing those who we are taught or conditioned to dislike or not care about, sometimes it's hard not to feel that we aren't banging our heads against a wall. But if enough people bang their heads against a wall, one day perhaps that wall will fall. This conference is exceptional because at most conferences, animal issues are not often put on the table. Animals themselves are usually on the table as the main course. Dr. Albert Schweitzer, who treated all beings who were ill and in need of equal care throughout his life, would not have understood that exclusion. When Dr. Schweitzer was a little boy, his mother made him say his prayers every night. He was taught to ask God for mercy for all human beings in the world. But when his mother left the room, Dr. Schweitzer would get out of his bed again and kneel down and add, "Dear God, please protect and bless all living creatures. Keep them all from evil and let them all sleep in peace. Amen." We see human compassion for caring and for callousness every day, but is there a greater context? Some years ago, there was a documentary film called The Animals Film. It showed how animals are used in warfare, starting with animals staked to the ground and put in cages on the decks of ships during the very first nuclear tests on Easter Island and Bikini Atoll. It showed monkeys imported into the U.S. and irradiated, fastened onto treadmills and forced to run until they died in their own vomit. It showed donkeys used to carry bombs and dogs used to test poisonous gases and left to die in convulsions. It also was about how animals are treated as inanimate objects these days, raised on factory farms where their beaks and their tails and their horns are cut out of their heads without as much as a painkiller. And it was about how whole families of elephants and parrots and other animals are slaughtered in Africa and South America so that their babies can be exported and kept their whole lives in chains and cages as nothing more than living toys or ornaments. And of course, all that still goes on. The advertisement for this film said, "The Animals Film. It's not about them, it's about us." Of course, it really was about them. They were the ones being treated badly and killed painfully. But the film was certainly about us, how we behave. It was about what we are thinking, or how thoughtless we can be, when we do violent things to others who we happen not to relate to, or who, in many cases, we simply dismiss as too unimportant to consider at all. Growing up in India, my mother's house was always full of human refugees, poor and disabled people, unwed mothers who had been cast out by their families, as well as orphaned animals. She always says, "It doesn't matter who needs help, it only matters that they do need help." I didn't realize at the time how wonderful and how uncommon that sentiment is. But I was reminded of her words when I heard this poem by W.S. Merwin called Good People. It reads, "From the kindness of my parents, I suppose it was, that I held that belief about suffering, imagining that if only it would come to the attention of any person with normal feelings, certainly anyone literate who might have gone to college, they would comprehend pain when it went on before them and would do something about it. Whenever they saw it happen in the time of pain, the present, they would try to stop the bleeding, for example, with their hands. But it escapes their attention, or there may be reasons for it, the victims under the blankets, the meat counters, the maimed children, the animals staring from the end of the world. The question is, why don't enough good people care? It's not as if reaching out to one group takes away from reaching out to another. The problem lies in the definition of me, of my people, and most of all, the definition of others. If we change those definitions, our work is done. Resistance is taught, and it is instinctual. It's not intellectual. To rid ourselves of our biases takes effort, and sometimes it takes an experience. The environmentalist Lauren Isley wrote a book in which he recounts a story of when he was living in a cabin in a desolate wilderness place. He trapped two sparrow hawks, a male and a female, to ship to a zoo in a faraway city. But the trapping was at night, and he slipped in the dark as he was moving the birds into a box. The male bird attacked Isley's thumb with his strong beak, injuring it badly, which allowed the hawk's mate to slip out of the box and fly off. When the light came up, Isley examined the male and found he was young and in good condition. The hawk glared at him with fierce eyes as Isley placed him in a small box and thought to himself that by tomorrow the bird would just be an episode. He would leave on the truck to live in a small cage in a city where he would spend the rest of his life. And a good thing, too, Isley thought, because he was sucking his aching thumb and spitting out blood. The next morning, Isley took the box in which the little hawk was imprisoned out onto the grass and started building a cage. As he worked in the sunshine, he thought to himself how fine a day it was to be alive. Then secretively he looked around the camp and he opened the box. He says, "I got the hawk out in my hand with his wings folded, and I was careful not to startle him. He didn't resist, and he lay limp in my grasp. I could feel his heart pound under his feathers, but he only looked beyond me and up. I saw him look that last look away, beyond me into a sky so full of light that I couldn't follow his gaze. I suppose then I must have realized what I was going to do. I just put the hawk on the grass. For a long minute, he simply lay with his breast pressed against the grass, and then he was gone like a flicker of light." Isley recalls, "He flew up into the towering emptiness of light and crystal that was so intense that my eyes could scarcely bear to penetrate it. There was silence. Then from far up somewhere, a cry. When I heard that cry, my heart turned over. It was not the cry of the hawk I had captured, for by shifting my position against the sun, I could see, coming straight out of the sun's eyes, where she must have been soaring restlessly above us for untold hours, hurtled his mate. And from far up, ringing from peak to peak, came a cry of such unutterable and ecstatic joy that it sounds down across the years as I write. They met in a great soaring gyre that turned into a whirling circle and a dance of wings. Once more, just once, their two voices joined in a harsh, wild medley of question and response echoing across the valley. Then they were gone forever, somewhere into those upper regions beyond the eyes of men. They were others who wished to be free as we do. Practicing nonviolence and nonviolent resistance in the face of violence directed towards us requires great strength. Yet it is an incredibly simple and easy task to act compassionately, as Isley decided to do in the end, and to be consciously nonviolent to those who present no threat to us whatsoever, which is the case with the passive animals we eat, for example. So why isn't this done as a matter of course? Again, it's a failure to recognize the us in the them. In Washington recently, I saw a bumper sticker on a car. It read, "I am you, only different." The car sped off before I could see if the driver was male or female, black or white, young or old. But maybe that was the point. The driver's identity wasn't important. It was the message. I am you, only different. Animals are you, too, only different. On Jewish Voice for Peace's website, there is this criticism. Aren't you Jews supporting terrorists who attack and kill your own people? And it's answered this way. Quite the opposite. We call all attacks what they are, war crimes. What a wonderful thing to get away from the obsession with the identity of the victims and perpetrators of violence and concentrate on stopping the violence itself. In Ecclesiastes, we are told, "For that which befalls the son of man befalls beasts. Even one thing befalls them. As the one dies, so dies the other. Yea, they all have one breath, so that man has no preeminence above a beast. For all is vanity. All go to one place. All are of the dust." The Hebrew term for a living soul, Nefesh Chaya, is applied in Genesis to animals as well as to people. And in Exodus 23:5, we are told, "If you see a donkey of your enemy lying under its burden, would you refrain from unloading it? You shall surely unload it with him," which shows the potential of compassion to transcend and even resolve human conflict. Temptations to separatism are ever present. When Martin Luther King, the icon of the U.S. civil rights movement, protested the Vietnam War, black clergy said he should stay out of it. It was a different issue. It wasn't violence specifically directed at black people. And Martin Luther King said these magnificent words, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." A movement is successful when it's diverse and it recognizes the larger context within which it lies. Violence affects all walks of life, human and animal, and to allow one form of violence to exist while asking for the eradication of the other seems painfully hypocritical. In the days of slavery, not so many decades ago, people in the United States honestly believed that African men did not feel pain as white men do, that African women did not experience maternal love as white women do. And so it was quite acceptable to brand men's faces with a hot iron and to auction off slaves' children and send them vast distances away from their mothers. All evidence was to the contrary, of course, yet highly educated people defied their own eyes and ears and common sense and their own ability to deduce by denying the facts before them, simply because society accepted the exploitation of these races. And it takes a commitment to break away from the norm, even when the norm is ugly and wrong. In Boston, only a few decades ago, a newspaper editorial appeared in which the editor stated, that women would never be admitted to Harvard or any other medical school because they would faint at the sight of blood. Women are now inarguably among the finest surgeons we have. Yet one might ask, how can women demand an end to male chauvinism when they are human chauvinists themselves? How can one people ask for recognition that their culture and their language and their independence is vital when they don't recognize these things for others who they in turn look down upon and who they can clearly see value these things too? Values must be universal. Principles must apply. Today, we have abolished human slavery, at least in theory. At least we know it's wrong. But we continue to enslave all the other animal species who, if we're honest with ourselves, show us clearly that they experience maternal love as we do, that if you burn them, they scream as we do, that they desire freedom from shackles as we do, and that if you tickle them, they giggle as we do. Examining whether or not our treatment of animals, these odd-looking others, is consistent with our stated nonviolent philosophy is vital to our own personal development as moral agents. If we feel it's asking too much of us to open our hearts and minds to animals' needs and their obvious, inescapable desire to be free of pain, too much to ask that they be treated as if they feel, which they do, then perhaps it's too much for us to ask others to understand those who are alien to them. War is a frightening thing for all living beings. Every day, millions of animals who pledge allegiance to no flag and who have done nothing to provoke aggression are the victims of the longest-running undeclared war in human history, the war on the animal nations. They are killed simply because someone is powerful enough to steal their land, run them out of their homes, take their young from them, cut them up and eat them, experiment on them, use their skins, treat them as amusements to jump and dance and be forced to fight for some human fleeting pleasure. They never can feel secure. They must creep and run. In 1917, 2 years before she was assassinated by the secret police, Rosa Luxemburg, a peace activist jailed for her opposition to World War I, wrote from her cell in the Breslau prison about war and animals. She recounted how soldiers outside her window mercilessly flogged a team of buffaloes who were war trophies from Romania. She wrote, "A lorry came laden with sacks, so overladen indeed that the buffaloes were unable to drag it across the threshold of the gate. The soldier driver belabored the poor beast so savagely with the butt end of his whip that the wardress at the gate, indignant at the sight, asked him, had he no compassion for animals? No more than anyone has compassion for us men, he answered, and redoubled his blows. Eventually, the animals, utterly exhausted, succeed in drawing the load over the obstacle and stand perfectly still. Miss Luxemburg wrote, the one that was bleeding had an expression on his face and in his soft black eyes like that of a weeping child, one who has been severely thrashed and does not know why nor how to escape from the torment of ill-treatment. She thinks of where these buffaloes have come from, the rich green meadows of another land, and how they are now objects of disdain for their nationality, and concludes, I had a visitation of all the splendor of war. Nonviolence can be expressed through kindness to the animal nations, the ultimate kindness being to leave them in peace and refrain from exploiting them, something we do only because we somehow, without thinking, suspend our dearly held belief that might does not make right. A nonviolence movement cannot stand silent while factory farm animals, whose meat is distributed worldwide, are forced to live their entire lives never seeing the sky or breathing fresh air, confined to spaces barely large enough for their bodies, pumped with drugs, beaten daily, fed deliberately nutrition-poor diets, and slaughtered in the most painful and heinous ways. A non-violence movement can't be complicit by ordering up one of the chickens in Ramallah's main square, Manara, who suffer in cramped cages under the brutal heat, without food, without water. A non-violence movement can't stand idly by while thirsty and underfed animals are beaten and forced to haul heavy loads, nearly breaking their backs.
Yes, and we're listening. This is Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM, the People's Station. We are listening to a wonderful, and I hope you're enjoying it as much as I do, presentation by Ingrid Newkirk, who is the founder of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. And this was a presentation that was made at the International Nonviolence Conference in Bethlehem. This presentation is called Nonviolence Includes the Animals. And let's get back to Ingrid Newkirk.
Mahatma Gandhi, who liberated India from the harsh yoke of the British Empire and is a father of the nonviolence movement, embraced a nonviolent diet and spoke forcefully against frightening animals and stealing their lives for a fleeting taste. The Nobel laureate, Isaac Bashevis Singer, whose family fled Nazi-occupied Europe, became a vegetarian when from the window of his rented room he saw cattle in shackles being beaten down a ramp to their deaths. Many Quakers and Grahams and suffragettes who fought for emancipation of women and the abolition of the slave trade refused meat so as to avoid violence to their own bodies and to animal life. People who try to justify mistreatment of animals by saying that they're stupid and they're dirty are using arguments that have been used historically against those who are marginalized and dismissed. When Sojourner Truth, the black woman campaigner for the abolition of slavery, was jeered at by white men and called stupid, she knew it would be too great a challenge to disabuse these men of their supremacist notion that only they were smart and that she could not be. So she said to them this. She said, "What if my little jug does only hold a pint and yours holds a quart? Wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full?" In other words, even if we believe ourselves to be superior, we are not entitled to be bullies. When I was 8, I left England to live in Asia. The culture I was used to was completely different from that of the other children I met. So was what I wore, how I appeared, my skin color, my language, and even many of my behaviors. The other children didn't understand me when I tried to communicate with them. They sometimes laughed at my attempts to be understood, and in one remote village, a boy actually came up and poked me with a stick, hard, probably just to see what I was made of. It's true that we don't comprehend the other animals' languages. Doesn't mean they don't have them. It is true that most humans are ignorant of animal cultures. Doesn't mean they don't have them. And that animals' behaviors and needs are quite often misunderstood. So they get poked with a lot of sticks, one way or the other. It isn't right for them any more than it was right for me. Before I describe what we have learned about animals over the last couple of decades that requires that we rethink our attitudes toward them, let me ask you to consider some religious perspectives that, like much in religion, get lost in the hurly-burly of daily life. The Quran preaches kindness to animals, stating that all creatures of Allah are sentient beings enough to attract our kindness, love, feelings, and compassion. Every kind of cruelty to animals is forbidden in Islam, which outlaws vivisection, the beating of animals, branding them, and baiting animals to fight. The Holy Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, preached compassion and kindness to all living beings. He condemned those who branded animals, confined animals, or tethered them up to practice target shooting, and he stated that it is a great sin for man to imprison those animals who are in his power. He said, "Whoever is kind to the creatures of God is kind to himself," and taught, "A good deed done to a beast is as good as doing good to a human being, while an act of cruelty to a beast is as bad as an act of cruelty to a human being." Why is this forgotten? The Garden of Eden is considered God's perfect world, as depicted in Genesis, and God's vision for the end times are depicted as vegetarian and totally nonviolent. Everything in between, which includes war, is not God's ideal. Jesus, looking for a metaphor to describe God's love for humanity, invoked a hen's love for her brood, a paragon of motherly devotion. And in the Sermon on the Mount, he preached, "Blessed are the merciful." He didn't say, "Blessed are the merciful to whom we readily relate." Many of us come to the theory of nonviolence because we have been personally affected by what violence has done to us or those close to us, and that's natural. But it must be the first step in a long walk. We must hold in our hearts and show in our actions a far deeper and broader opposition to violence. During the Vietnam War, thousands of young American men fled to Canada. Many as conscientious objectors to war, but many because they simply didn't want to be killed, not because they thought other people should not be killed either, not because of opposition to war. Near the same time as those protests against the Vietnam War, women were marching in Washington, demanding equal pay for equal work, and people with disabilities were blocking roads in their wheelchairs, demanding access and an end to discrimination. Of course, no one should be killed unjustly or at all, and no one should be discriminated against. But I must not be for women's rights because I am a woman, but because I understand that principle. Gandhi asserts that the most significant moral characteristics of a nation are its capacity for charity, and that one can measure a nation's greatness not by its achievements, its scientific advances, or its contribution to arts and literature, or by its power and influence in the world, but by its treatment of animals. Why? Because animals are so alien to us, they are so dissimilar in their appearance, that it is hardest for us to relate to them. That is our test. After Hurricane Katrina, the New Orleans Superdome, which is a giant indoor football stadium, was used to temporarily house tens of thousands of mostly poor people who were left homeless by the floods. Conditions inside quickly deteriorated, and emergency food and water rations weren't delivered. One man appeared and said on television, "They are leaving us here to die like dogs." We hear that expression, and the implication of it is that somehow it is an appropriate fate for a dog to be abandoned without food and water, but not an acceptable fate for humans. Ironically, most animals aren't treated like animals. Their miserable existences as meat on the hoof, beasts of burden forced to carry heavy loads almost to the breaking point and sometimes to the breaking point, the way they're warehoused together like boxes on a shelf, their lives in cages and irons, denies them everything natural about their lives. Poultry in most countries today, for example, are often bred to gain so much weight so quickly that they can't even reproduce without artificial intervention. Treated like animals is the wrong metaphor. These animals are not treated like animals. They are treated like things, like commodities, machines, and objects. They are treated like everything but as animals. No one has to choose between animals and humans. We are obviously all important. My baby may be more important to me than someone else's baby, but I can't rightly say there is no single baby that is more important than my baby. All babies are important. Similarly, the news that many elderly citizens in New Orleans were left to drown in their nursing home beds is a tragedy in itself, without having to have their lives ranked against the youth or the able-bodied. All are important. Our compassion is not some mean thing, like a cake with only a few slices you can take from it. Before I leave you, let us look at who animals are. They're not what. Their very name, animal, comes from the Latin word anima, meaning life. I could give you thousands of examples of animals clearly demonstrating high degrees of abstract thinking, complex communication, emotions, individuality, unique transmission of culture, and all the other characteristics, talents, and abilities that some think are exclusively human. The average dog, it has been found, painstakingly masters 200 words of his family's language without being taught. A blind deer was found in Pennsylvania with the hair on her right side worn away from the companionship of another deer who guided her until he was shot through the forest by always being on her right side. The albatross was the first being to circumnavigate the globe. Turtles navigate by the Earth's magnetic field. Locusts make polymers that penetrate crops. Ants build boats to cross streams. Vervet monkeys use different words to describe to each other a stranger and a familiar face, a threat from land, from sea, or from the air. Bats bring food to neighbors when they're sick. The bird lures the hunter away from her nest by feigning a broken wing. The crow amuses himself by riding the air currents and then sliding down the windows on his bottom. The chimpanzee uses tools. So does the jackdaw. The desert mouse rolls a little stone in front of her burrow to catch the dew. The elephant cradles the bones of her dead relatives in her trunk and remembers, tears pouring down her face. In New York, a cat suffered deep burns as she returned to a burning building over and over to take out her kittens. The humble cow has a eureka moment, jumping with joy and kicking up her heels when she figures out how to open a new gate. The octopus learns how to open a jar by watching a person do the same. The sheep stops trembling when another sheep comes to comfort him. The mouse in the laboratory hears the door opening, and in sheer anticipation of bad things to come, his heart starts to pound, his adrenaline levels rise, and his pulse races. All these things have been measured, witnessed, studied, published. But permit me to focus on one quality that is said to be the private domain of humans, morality. Experimenter Stanley Weschlin showed that a rhesus monkey would not take food if doing so meant that another monkey received an electric shock. In a variation of this experiment, macaque monkeys were fed only if they were willing to pull a chain and electrically shock an unrelated macaque whose agony was in plain view through a one-way mirror. Otherwise, they starved. After learning the ropes, the monkeys frequently refused to pull the chain. In one experiment, only 13% of the monkeys would do so, which meant 87% of the monkeys made the decision to go hungry. One macaque went without food for almost 2 weeks rather than hurt his fellow. Macaques who had themselves been shocked in previous experiments were even less likely to pull the chain. They related. The human beings who designed this experiment were unable to relate. The behavior of the macaques can't be attributed to instinct. Their actions were moral choices. This is the most beautiful demonstration of the classic religious imperative to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Finally, we are sometimes afraid to be like the other animals, and that is a matter of vanity. Frightened people speak of the danger of anthropomorphism, attributing what they call human nature to animals. But it isn't human nature, it's shared nature. All animals laugh and lie and cheat and love and experience emotions. To say they do not is anthropodenial, the denial that we have erected false barriers to keep these others out. Deciding not to eat animals is an important step in wiping the violence from our lives. If we pay someone else to slit a throat, it's the same as if we did that deed ourselves. It's like being opposed to war, but investing our income in companies that build missile launchers. It makes no sense for the nonviolent in word to support butchery in any form in deed. I'm often asked, why don't you eat meat? Why are you a vegetarian? It's an innocent enough question, but when you think about it, it's like asking someone why they don't kill other people. Most of us don't crave flesh, even if we think we do. The authors of Fit for Life once wrote this. They said, if you put an apple and a rabbit in a playpen with a child, and the child plays with the apple and eats the rabbit, I'll buy you a new car. Humans don't get hungry looking at a live chicken the way, say, a cat, a true carnivore, might. Our meat has to be cooked, it has to be spiced and disguised so that we don't feel disgust, because we still retain, and we should make sure that we do, our sensitivity to what Tolstoy called the casual horror of the slaughterhouse. In Deuteronomy we read, "Justice, justice shall you pursue," meaning that justice can only be achieved through justice. Perhaps nonviolence, too, can only be achieved through nonviolent behavior. It can begin with our breakfast, and it can be part of everything we do all day. Once we have confronted our own biases and made peace with all the others around us, it will be as if we ourselves have let the sparrowhawk out of his unjust prison, spared his life, and reunited him with those who love him. Then truly, the peace process has begun. I wish you all great peace in your hearts and great energy in your important work. Thank you.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices, and we've just heard a wonderful presentation by Ingrid Newkirk, and she's the president of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA. The presentation is called Nonviolence Includes Animals. And this was a presentation she gave at the Nonviolence Conference in Bethlehem. So, many of her CDs and DVDs are available at the PETA webpage, which is PETA.org. And, John, you have some music for us. And then we'll be listening to another cut from Ingrid Newkirk, and it's called Be Kind. Over to John.
If I had a wish, I'd wish for apples and pears. Or maybe I'd wish for tomorrow, one wish for you and for me. But if I had two wishes, then maybe I'd wish for three. Wishes are easy, but how do you make them come true? I learned the hard way, so I'll make it easy for you. Work hard every day, believe in yourself, till others believe in you too. Then take all your wishes and make all your wishes come true. Work hard at your wishes, may all of your wishes come true. And that's my wish for you.
Without invisible labels on us that say food or lab tool or whatever it is that the others are not so lucky to have escaped. But they're us. They're just like us. There are probably industry people and even federal agents here, so I want to say welcome. It's perhaps very easy to make fun of the feds. They're usually looking for the wrong people because that's more convenient. That's easier than looking for the other ones. There are the federal agriculture inspectors. One has to mention them. I don't know if you read about the federal agriculture inspector in Utah who went into a restaurant where they served four egg quiches, and she said, you can't do that anymore because the information is that one in every four eggs is infected with salmonella, so you'll have to make three egg quiches from now on. It's a true story. And the manager said, well, what if we throw away from the carton one out of every four eggs? And she said, well, let me check with my supervisor. But that said, I've seen massive changes. I know a woman who used to work for the FBI who became a PETA undercover investigator, a federal inspector who blew the whistle on what was happening to animals in laboratories, and I know a former NRA spokesperson who is now a vegan and has written perhaps the best essay I've ever read about why you shouldn't fish. So I don't think we should give up on anyone. I was in San Antonio a little while ago, a few months ago, on what used to be the biggest working cattle ranch in Texas. It is called Black Creek. It's owned by a woman she married, this man Johnson, who headed the Johnson Ranch Syndicate. And it is now a sanctuary for abused cattle. She took me around in the converted jeeps that used to be used to go out and just pick off animals. And they've been converted now as sort of safari jeeps, so you can go out and watch the animals just being themselves. And there was a chief ranch hand there who, very tall, lanky Texan, he'd been there about 40 years. He wore a Stetson. He had vegan cowboy boots. And we had a private talk that evening, and he said, I can't tell you some of the things that used to go on here. He said, you know about castration and dehorning and these things, but he said, not only to the cattle, but to the horses, the things we did were horrific. But he said, when this vegan lady came along, I didn't know how it was going to be, but I was willing to give it a shot. And he said, now I can look the cattle in the eye. And he said, it's just a wonderful place to work. And he meant it. Things are changing. I was just writing a book, a chapter for a book this week, and I wanted to talk about vegan weddings. And I found I had this enormous choice of people who had had vegan weddings that I could interview. And I chose Dawn and Chris Pelosi from rural Pennsylvania. They were high school students when they met. They had never met a vegan. Chris was a deer hunter, would go out every season with his grandfather and blow deer away. Dawn went to Penn State one day, and she was in the library. She picked up an issue of Peter's Animal Times, and she read an article on factory farming. And she thought it was very interesting. She took it home and she showed it to Chris. And about a week later, they were sitting down to dinner, and their dog, Keisha, was by their side. They love Keisha. Keisha, they're very protective of her. She was born with a congenital heart defect. And Chris just looked at the chicken leg on his plate, and he said, suddenly he thought, what on earth am I doing? This could be Keisha's leg. And so, of course, they stopped eating animals, and they learned more. He stopped hunting and the whole nine yards, so they're vegan. So I thought I'd put them in the book. I interviewed them, and I said, what was the hardest part of having a vegan wedding in rural Pennsylvania? I said, was it that the relatives were clamoring for you to serve meat? And Dawn said, well, no, because we said to them when they brought it up that what kind of people would we be on our wedding day that we would violate our principles? And what kind of guests would they be that, knowing how we feel, they would demand that we serve animals on this special occasion? So I said, okay, was it difficult getting a vegan wedding cake? And they said, no, not at all. We had this banana cream four-layer thing with vanilla frosting. It was easy. So I said, well, help me here. Was there anything that was hard to do for a vegan wedding? And they said, yes. We couldn't find a limousine that didn't have leather seats. But she said it worked out beautifully because we ended up hiring a party bus with plastic seats, and we could put everybody in it. So instead of going separately to the church, the whole family went to the church in this party bus and had a better time than they ever would have. So it's great. It's happening. Anyway, back to veganism. I think it is the most powerful statement that we can make, powerful ethical statement. And today's young people, thank God, are embracing it in such numbers that it is putting all the other generations to shame. People ask me all the time, what does it mean? Do you eat this? Do you eat that? Do you do this? Do you do that? And so I devised what I call is the double S rule. It's very, very simple. Nothing stolen, nothing slaughtered. Milk, it's stolen. Bacon, it's slaughtered. Eggs, stolen. You can have beans and rice and jalapenos and beer. It's okay. But leather, slaughtered. Wool, stolen. Fur, slaughtered. When people put on a fur coat, you know, they have to be standing in their bedroom, living room, whatever. They have to be putting it on and thinking, I look good in this. And the reason they're wearing it is that they hope that people will think well of them, that they'll think they look beautiful. That's why they're putting it on. And when you say something to them, like anything you might say to them, it shatters that illusion. And the next time they go to put it on, they're going to play those audio tapes in their minds of what happened last time, and they're going to be less inclined to wear it. And the reason the double S rule works, I think, is because what kind of person can actually come and argue with you that it's all right to steal and it's all right to slaughter? That's like defending rapes and muggings and murders. One of my favorite quotes is from Dave Allen of the Gang of Four. He said, one day I reached out to eat something and it ran away. Obviously, it didn't want to be eaten. And others of them swim and crawl and fly away. They don't want to be eaten either, and they don't want to have things stolen from them, things that are theirs, that they worked for. Like even the little honey bee who works so hard to make the honey for the hive, that nourishes the hive, that keeps them safe, and we come along and smoke them out and replace it with cheap sugar. We shouldn't do that. In the New York Times magazine a few weeks ago, there was a food writer. He wasn't a vegetarian, but he said he was taken aback when he chopped up one lobster in front of others that were on his kitchen counter. And the others waved their antennae at him and backed away, falling over each other. Cam McQueen, who's a local activist here, wrote that when she went into a restaurant kitchen, a commercial restaurant kitchen, she saw crabs that were covered in batter and left by a boiling pot. One crab had separated himself out from the bunch, and he was trying to move away, even though he couldn't see where he was going because he had batter in his eyes. And she said, at that moment, I realized that all animals want to escape the pot. Several people asked if I would repeat two of the stories I told in Berkeley, and so I will. These are stories that help us, I hope, explain to others why we feel the way we feel. The first story is the truck story, which is about, at this moment, imagining that these doors burst open and into this room come men who are much bigger and much stronger than we are, and with intimidation and cudgels, they force us into the center of the room here, and we're very, very frightened, and they're beating up on us. And one of them breaks your nose, and one of them breaks your ribs, and one of them breaks your leg. And you're in pain, and we don't know what's happening. And we are herded into the middle of this room. And they then take us out, and they put us up this ramp onto this truck. And when we're in the truck, we understand that they're going to kill us. There's nothing we can do. They're much bigger and stronger than we are. We're driving along. We're going for hours. We're jostling against each other, trying to stay upright, frightened. And the driver won't talk to us, and we're thirsty, and we can't get anything to drink. And we understand from others who are already on the truck that this is actually happening all over the U.S. right now. There's a whole convoy of trucks. They've started rounding people up from movie theaters and auditoriums and schools and everything, and they're going to kill them. And someone even says they're going to make things out of our skin. And the truck is going along, and it comes to an abrupt stop at a light. And just at that moment, the back of the truck, the door, swings open just for a second. And one of us manages to roll out. And then the truck goes on, and the door closes permanently. And that one is you. You got away. And the rest of us are looking through the slats, and we're watching you. And we're rooting for you, and you're running, and we see you. You get behind a box or a lamppost or a tree, and you're out of breath, and you're catching your breath. And you get yourself together, and we see you just running. And we're thinking, thank God he got away or she got away. And we know that you are our hope, because you are going to tell the world what's happening, this terrible thing that is happening to us. And you're going to go and get help. And somehow you make it back to your apartment, and you close the door, and you sit there, and you gain your composure. And then you take a shower, and then you put on the TV, and then you call some friends and ask if they'd like to go out. And then you pick up a magazine and you read it, and you forget us. Our hope out the window. And that really is what's happening. Because it's the definition of us. Who are we? It's a silly story, but it's not a silly story, because we are the ones who got away. We are so lucky, whether it's just some cosmic thing or divine intervention, it's just happenstance. We were born without invisible labels on us that say food, or lab tool, or whatever it is that the others are not so lucky to have escaped. But they're us. They're just like us. That should be the definition of us. What happens to any animal happens to all of us.
And we've been listening to a presentation now of Ingrid Newkirk. She's the president of PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And her presentation was called Veganism. Many of the CDs and DVDs are available by going to their webpage, which is PETA.org, PETA.org. Thank you, Ingrid Newkirk, for speaking out so well for the animals. And this is, my name's Carl, and thank you, John, for being our technician today, John Pranger, and we'll be back next week. Thank you for listening.